Grab your Bible and open it to Numbers chapter 22, where we are going to talk about the attack of Moab against Israel. Now, they don't attack them outright because the king of Moab understands that he doesn't have the wherewithal to mount a military assault against the Israeli people. In fact, historically, he has just recently lost the northern portion of his territory to the Amorite king Sihon, that Israel just cleaned his clocks and took his land. Israel is sitting in the plains of Moab, which is a little pocket there on the flat area of the Jordan Valley floor on the east side of the river, across from Jericho, immediately north of the Dead Sea. And the king of Moab wants his land back. But even though the aggressor against him is now gone, Israel is now controlling that property. If you can't beat them in the physical, then you have to be taking care of it in the spiritual. That's what this story is going to be about. So chapter 22 of Numbers says this: Then the people of Israel set out and they camped in the plains of Moab beyond the Jordan at Jericho. And you all know that I like to imagine what it must have been like to be in this historical situation. Keep in mind that the Holy Land, the Promised Land, really isn't a monstrously large place. We here in North America, we here in the United States in particular, our perspective is very big. We have big, wide spaces. But in Israel, everything's close and tight. It's only about maybe 10 miles at the most from the tabernacle tent in the Israeli encampment across the Jordan River to the city of Jericho. The people over in Jericho can see God's glorious cloud, especially at night when it's burning bright. They can see it. The people living up and down the Jordan and Dead Sea Valley, if they've got a line of sight on the new encampment of Israel, they can see God's tower of glory blazing in the night. And so they know that something scary is happening in their life because they've heard about these Israelis, how 40 years ago their God got them out of Israel or out of Egypt with great power, causing a whole bunch of plagues, breaking the economy of the Egyptians, how they crossed the Red Sea supernaturally and ended up with a whole bunch of charioteer forces of Egypt being drowned. They've heard about how this group has been wandering around in the Sinai wilderness where there's no food, there's no water, but they sure have it because God is providing it for them. And so that is the context that I want you to imagine Moab being a part of when this is all taking place. So the king of Moab does this. Verse 2, Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. So how they had destroyed Sihon, his army, took his cities, took his property, and then did the same thing to Og, who was a giant of a man, and his armies and his properties. Verse 3, and Moab was in great dread of the people because they were many. You know that the census that appears at the beginning of the book of Numbers has over 600,000 men on the list that will inherit property. So that's a big group of people. So Moab said to the elders of Midian. Now, this is a little strange here. Midian is south and apparently a little bit east from the southern border of Moab. Midian is where Moses had spent the last 40 years of his life before the Exodus occurred. So 40 years ago is the last time that Moses was in Midian. The Midianites and the Moabites have apparently entered into some sort of trade relationship over the past 40 years. And so when Moab feels threatened by the presence of the Israelis, the king reaches out to the Midianite neighbors to the southeast and triggers that alliance. He says, "This horde will now lick up all that is around us as the ox licks up the grass of the field." So he lets the Midianites know, it's not going to stop with us. You know, if he takes over our territory, just like he took over the Amorites' territory, he's going to come for you next. And so those are the shared concerns that trigger this alliance. So Balak, the son of Zippor, who was king of Moab at that time, sent messengers to Balaam, who was the son of Beor at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of the people of Ammah, or possibly the land of his people, to call him. Now let's talk about where Balaam is. Some people believe that Pethor is near the ancient city of Carchemish, which is west of the Euphrates River after it's made its little bend there north of the Promised Land. And I understand why they believe that, because of the similarity in the name. But in our Bible text, which is the one that we trust, we will later be told that Balaam is from Aram Naharaim, or the Aram that is between the rivers, the place from which Abraham came to the Promised Land. And so it is much more likely that Pethor is somewhere just north of the Euphrates River in that same region as Ur and Haran, the place where the Israelis came from, the place where some of their relatives still lived. I believe that that is the reason why this prophet is attached to the God of Israel. Because God, of course, is God Most High to the people of Abraham's family members still up there in Mesopotamia. And so this man, Balaam, has some sort of prophetic relationship with God Most High. And he must be good at his job. He must have a fame that goes far and wide, that anything he says from God happens exactly as God said. Now, we know that there are pockets of God's influence in other areas outside the immediate activities that we've seen in Scripture. Because remember, God was dealing with Abraham up in Mesopotamia. At the same time, he was already dealing with Melchizedek down at Salem or Jerusalem, because Melchizedek was priest of God Most High, same God that called Abraham. In fact, Melchizedek's faith and service to God predates that of Abraham. And so my thesis is that Balaam may in fact be related somehow to the Israelis by many years of separation. And that he's living in the same region that Abraham came out of, and that he is therefore serving God Most High. And because he has been so effective, since he's working for the real God, Balak sees him as someone that could make a difference in the spirit world for him. Because even though he can't beat Israel in the physical realm, if he can pummel Israel in the spiritual realm, that might give him a chance. So this is what he says. We're back in the second part of verse 5. Behold, a people has come out of Egypt. They cover the face of the earth, or the face of the land, and they are dwelling opposite me. So they're not very far from where I have full control right now. Come now, curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them from the land, for I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed. Now, did you hear that wording? Remember, when Abraham first came into relationship with God, God told him, Abraham, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. And I will be a blessing to you and a curse to your enemies. So here we have the reality that Balaam seems to have a similar connection with apparently the same God that Abraham served, which means the same God that the Israelites are living under his protection right this moment, there in the plains of Moab. So Balak says, if you'll come and curse them, that'll give me a chance to beat them in the physical world. Verse 7, so the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the fees for divination in their hand. So we've got an entourage made up of both Moabite leaders and Midianite leaders. And they come prepared to pay for the services of Balaam. They see this as being something mercenary. So he said to them, lodge here tonight, and I will bring back word to you as he who is speaks to me. Now, it's, if I'm correct, that we're talking about the same place that Abraham came from, then it's about a 10 day to 2 week trip one way. Unless, of course, you're riding on horses or camels or something that can move along a little faster than our own feet can carry us. So it could have been as much as a week, perhaps, if you got a little bit faster transport. And so they take that time, get up there, and immediately meet with him to request his assistance. And his response is, you can spend the night, I'll check in with God and get back with you. Now notice that the name He Who Is appears in the quotations from Balaam. Now, is that Moses putting it in because he is aware that Balaam serves the same God? Or has Balaam had some inside information about the God that he is serving has this special name? And my suspicion, and that's all it is it's more of Moses trying to keep this very clear to his readers. So the princes of Moab stayed with Balaam, and God said to Balaam, or came to Balaam and said, who are these men with you? Now, God already knows, we've talked about this before, this is to give Balaam the opportunity to function as his office requires. He is a prophet, so he speaks on behalf of God. He speaks to God on behalf of other people. So who are these people? And he says back to them, to God, Balak the son of Zippor, king of Moab, has sent to me saying, behold, a people has come out of Egypt. It covers the face of the earth or the land. Come, curse them. Perhaps I'll be able to fight against them and drive them out. Very specific to what Balak's message was. God said to Balaam, you shall not go up with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed. So right out of the box, Balaam is told, no, these people are not to be cursed by you. They are under my blessing. So Balaam is compliant at the very beginning. Balaam rose in the morning, said to the princes of Balak, go to your own land, for he who is has refused to let me go with you. So the princes of Moab rose and went to Balak and said, Balaam refuses to come with us. And so now it's been another week, 10 days, 2 weeks. So we're probably already a good part of a month, or maybe just over a month in the story. And if it had stopped here, it would have ended a whole lot differently, wouldn't it? But instead, Balak once again sent princes or leaders more in number and more honorable than these. So he puts even higher ranked people to go on this trip. And they came to Balaam. So another 10 days to 2 weeks. And they said to him, thus says Balak, the son of Zippor, let nothing hinder you from coming to me, for I will surely do you great honor. And whatever you say to me, I will do. Come curse this people for me. So this time the message is, I'm telling you, this is important. You've got to do it. Money is no object. It's a blank check situation, Balaam. And so now money becomes a very significant part of the story. Verse 18, but Balaam answered and said to the servants of Balak, though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not go beyond the command of he who is my God to do less or more. Now that's good. I wished he'd stuck with that commitment. Verse 19, so you too, please stay here tonight that I may know more from he who is, what he will say to me. So even though he already had a message from God, he decides to go and ask again. Now that is the beginning of the shift. Because now he's going to go back and ask God to reconsider something that God has already been very plain about. Verse 20, God came to Balaam at night and said to him, if the men have come to call you, rise, go with them. But only do what I tell you. So God does give permission, and we already know, those of us that have been students of this a long time, and this is a very familiar story. It's a spoiler alert for those of you that maybe have never heard this story. God is going to use him to put more blessings on Israel. In fact, he will include a prophecy that is double-pronged. It is a prophecy about the kingdom of David and Solomon against Moab, as well as a prophecy of the coming of Mashiach, the Messiah, Jesus, and what he will do. So he's given permission to go, but he is reminded that he can only say and do what God gives him express permission to say and do. That's important. So Balaam rose in the morning, saddled his donkey, and went with the princes of Moab. Now it's at this point that I want to read to you from 2 Peter, chapter number 2, where Peter is complaining about all the false teachers that are infiltrating the church and how they are just full of greed, full of themselves. They're always trying to make a denarius off of other people, trying to to get wealthy from the backs and misuse of other people. And he, in verse number 14, says this: "They have eyes full of adultery, insatiable for sin. They entice unsteady souls. They have hearts trained in greed. Accursed children, forsaking the right way, they have gone astray. They have followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved gain for wrongdoing, but was rebuked for his own transgression. A speechless donkey spoke with human voice and restrained the prophet's madness." Nipped it in the bud is actually what it tries to say here. And so it is at this point in our story, back in Numbers 22, from God giving him permission to leave and actually being on the road, that Balaam's heart begins to be turned by wealth. Apparently, the more he thought about the promises of silver and gold, the more he tried to figure out how he could do what he was being asked to do by Balak, the guy that holds the purse strings. And my guess is that he was going through in his mind wording of how he was going to verbalize something that would be acceptable to Balak, but maybe still dodge God telling him that he was supposed to only be doing a blessing ceremony. And so my reason for thinking that this is when it was going on in his mind, or that this was what was going on in his mind, is because of verse 22. "But God's anger was kindled because he went." Now, you already know from a previous verse that God gave him express permission to go. So God is not mad that he went because God gave him permission to go. So why is God upset with him going? God is upset with him going because of his attitude now. That's why I was presenting this concept that he's trying to figure out a way to get that cash. So what does God do about it? It says, "An angel of he who is took his stand in the way as his adversary." So God dispatches an angel. Now, angels are creatures of multiple dimensions, and they can be, in our dimension, either invisible totally, or visible, or, weirdly enough, some combination thereof. And in this case, the angel is going to be invisible to humanity, because there's people traveling with Balaam, and they don't see anything. But visible to the animal. So the angel, with a drawn sword apparently, like back in, you know, Garden of Eden time, with the story of the Keruvim that take their stand at the edge of the Garden of Eden, this angel stands right in the path. Now, he, Balaam, was riding on the donkey, and his two servants were with him. And the donkey saw the angel of he who is standing in the road with a drawn sword in his hand, and the donkey turned aside out of the road and went off into the field. Now, this donkey has been around a while. I did some research. Donkeys' average lifespan in the 30s, 30 years, 33, 34, something like that. They can live up into the 40s, but that's a pretty old donkey. So this donkey is probably a pretty old donkey. We'll find that out later. And so it's gleaned a lot of things in its life. And one of the things that I'm sure it's gleaned is fear of strangers, especially strangers with scary weapons. And so the moment the donkey sees that, the donkey She veers around into the field along the side of the road. So Balaam struck the donkey. He's got a little rod probably in his hand, or maybe he's got a little donkey whip, and he starts whacking to get the donkey back on the road, to turn her back into the road. So then the angel of the Lord, the angel of He who is, stood in a narrow path between the vineyards with a wall on either side. So the angel moves down the road, pops in to a more narrow spot where there's walls protecting vineyards on each side of the path. When the donkey saw the angel of He who is, she pushed against the wall and pressed Balaam's foot against the wall. So she tries to go around the angel and ends up scraping Balaam's foot against that rock wall, and that had to have hurt. And so he struck her again. Then verse 26, as we're kind of going to have to stop with a cliffhanger here in a moment. The angel of He who is went ahead and stood in an even more narrow place where there was no way to turn either to the right or to the left. So there's only room for a donkey, but the angel's in that spot. So when the donkey saw the angel of He who is, she laid down under Balaam. So she just said, I am not moving any farther. I'm going to just lay down and wait until this gets resolved. And Balaam's anger was kindled, and he struck the donkey with his staff. He starts wailing on her with his stick. And that's when the miracle occurs that we will talk about the next time we're into the Word. God opened the mouth of the donkey, and she starts talking to Him about the unfairness of this very situation.